Abby.
And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hey, you guys.
Hi.
How are you?
Oh, me? I'm great. How are you?
Oh, just dandy.
Dandy. That is all of New England right now, no?
This is the best time to be here.
Yes. How are you guys doing? Where are you? What's the weather like? Because here, it is the one time a year that all New Englanders kind of lose our point. We lose our focus. We are typically cranky. We want to complain. We want to be frustrated. But you know what? The weather's great. All of our favorite foods are out. The leaves, they're peeping.
They're peeping. We're getting a little bit crispy here. It's a little bit chillier in the morning. We're getting into sweater weather.
There's sweaters. We don't need a coat yet. The sun's out, but it's not too hot. And you know what? Everybody at Dunk's is making their drinks with love. It is the time of year that they say, no, no, my heart's vision sees your vision today. So here is your perfect butter pecan iced latte.
Yes. And we say that as we sit here with our Dunkies.
Yeah, with my butter pecan iced latte.
And I have my caramel iced regular. I don't know what that says about me.
Did you know that other places in the country do not know what a regular is?
It's just regular cream and sugar. What do you mean?
Yeah, well, out here, you guys have a real weird sense of what's regular.
Oh.
And it's not weird as though it's bad. It's weird as though everybody assumes it's the same thing. And you go anywhere else and they're like, I don't know how you take your coffee regular. Like, what the fuck is your regular?
Well, I mean, to me, that's just a Dunk's thing because like they have their normal cream and sugar, like what goes with the size. And then I'm like, yeah, do that. Don't fuck with it. Just keep it. And I will say this, and this might be an unpopular opinion, but the new branding that Dunk's has done where it's just Dunkin', I missed that old school white sign that Dunkin' Donuts they were in like dilapidated buildings and like it was sketchy and the dumpster out back was like too close to the building. Like I missed the days where Dunk's looked different, when it looked worse.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I think the nicer the building, the worse the coffee.
Every now and then.
And I've seen that in Dunk's, so I'm still going to just call it my Dunk's, even though like Dunkin'.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, I like Dunk's. I like Dunkies. My best friend in college, Erica, we'd go to Dunk's all the time, and we had all these little videos. Like, I get them on Snapchat memories of us, like, literally ice-picking her car out of the snow to be like, Dunkies! Like, we gotta go.
Because you have to do what you have to do. There are so few things. There are so few things. And when you just want
one freaking iced coffee.
Yes. And you don't want to spend $8 on it.
No. And you don't want the shitty bean juice from school where they're like, this is coffee. And I've been drinking coffee since God only knows middle school, probably. And I'm like, this is bullshit. Mm-hmm. This is not coffee. And they're like, but it is. I'm going to Dunk's.
And you're welcome to come with me if you'd like to.
Yeah. And we're going to go and we're going to listen to Ariana Grande on the way.
I'm listening to a podcast.
I know.
I'm on my way and it's getting spoopy.
It is. I am in love with this time of year. It is my favorite time of year. But I am having just like a teeny tiny bit of FOMO for like fun, stupid, silly summer nights. You know?
We can still have fun, super silly summer nights.
I know. And they'll come next year. And now we'll have fun, stupid, silly fall nights.
Yeah.
But there is a slight difference. And mostly what I'm realizing is I just really miss Randall. Good friend of the pod. But he is just so fun. I don't know. I haven't gone out with him in forever. I normally go and see him every year for his birthday. And I didn't get to this year. And so now I'm like kicking rocks over here. I'm like, what? But I want to get ready together.
Okay, but it's my birthday.
I know. And now we're celebrating your birthday, which is a totally different, just as fun, very fun. Get ready. Go out. Have a good girls' night.
I joke because we're doing that today.
Today.
It's a very autumnal day here. Mm-hmm. If you guys could, let us know where you're listening from.
Yeah.
If you want to leave a little comment down. We have a spiced pumpkin candle going.
Sure do.
On the burner. We have our coffees. We are in comfy clothes and we are just feeling this fall day, this fall time, trying to be
festive. We're tapping in.
Did you know we got a flood of messages that last episode we did not Yoohoo.
Oh, oh my God.
We did not Yoohoo. I say we. You did not Yoohoo.
Well, you could.
So that is, I think,
a deep apologies. We'll do a double Yoohoo when we start today.
Yeah.
For your loss. And you know what? If I'm feeling generous, I'll throw in a third for interest. Our apologies. Really, customer service is the heart of our association. And
and here at ATFTC, we value yours.
We are all about service.
Yes.
Get your triple Yoo-hoos today.
We just appreciate your business. And by that, we mean listening to us. But I will say, I think that there's so much awful in the world.
Yeah.
The last few weeks, we have just seen some of the worst of humanity.
Yeah.
And it just seems to continue. And I think with recent events, it really makes you think about your life and what you prioritize and the people that you love. And then I kind of switched to like thinking of Dean Corll.
Yeah.
And thinking of these victims and just like the depravity in this case.
Oh, it's awful.
I mean, the research has had me like crying. It's had me all caps anger texting. It's had me diving into research, diving into old newspapers I've never heard of, just to try to figure out what they were thinking at the time.
Yeah.
And just really cannot stress enough how much I would recommend the book The Man with the Candy by Jack Olson, and just really diving into this case and seeing the depravity. I just, you can't help but picture in your mind what it must have been like.
Right.
And it's like this all-consuming dread. It's just, it's pure evil. It just is.
It is. And in all honesty, like, especially in regards to last week and just honestly this whole series, like, we have been living, eating, breathing, sleeping Dean Corll. And these episodes that we're putting together, you know, whether they're an hour and a half or two, that's what ends up produced to you guys. That isn't the hours of research reading. It's not the hours of writing. It's not the recording and then the editing and then the publishing. And while that is something we like to do, it is sometimes really disheartening to have your hobby be so all consumed by like the most evil things people can do, living in a time where we're seeing such difficult things going on outside, no matter who you are. Like, just everything has seemed real glum on top of it. And so truly an apology for the Yoohoo, because sometimes the levity is missed when we are drowning in the depravity.
And I think, you know, I think that a lot of you, and we've heard from a lot of you, that you like to listen to us because we're great. No, I'm just kidding. But that you appreciate that we attack sort of these cases with as much factual information as we can. We'll give our personal opinions. You'll know that there are personal opinions.
Yeah.
But we do try to bring in some levity. And then we try to also just focus on, okay, well, this happened. And I believe that everything happens for a reason. And sometimes people really don't like that. It can be kind of a provocative thing to say. But it's just what I believe and I have to. And I hope to advocate for change. And like a situation like this, these were horrific things that never should have happened.
Yeah.
Yet they did. So now what? Now how do we change that? How do we ensure that it doesn't happen again? How do we, you know, I think a lot of positive legislative change happened as a result of this, and the way that the, you know, for this case in particular, the police were really discouraged from acting on a lot of this, and some of the police just did sloppy work and bad work. We're going to talk a lot about that in our final part, but because if you thought this was the last part, you're very sadly mistaken. But that there were also a lot of police that were like, we aren't doing enough, we're not properly funded, we do not have the manpower to attack what is quite literally called the murder capital of the country.
Yes.
So taking all of these things into, you know, to consideration, I think that these horrific things happened, and yet can we use that to allow it not to happen again?
Well, and I think we make a good team on this, not only because we do both really care about the facts and how to come out of it, because again, you can't change what happened.
No, we don't pretend to have all the answers, but we do want to spark the conversation and hope that you guys are joining us.
But I also appreciate that we'll both just sit here and think about it and try to provide that context and try to sort of connect it to what that might look like or mean today. Because I think for me, when it comes to these cases that are so big and so heavy and so depletingly awful, that it can be hard to find people that are willing to take the extra time and spend the extra time thinking about the awful thing to put it into context to better know.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminds me, as someone who grew up in the Bible Belt, like going to churches that would teach things from the Bible, but they would really give it context to like, oh, this is the book that was written. This is who was writing it. This is who it's to, versus going to some churches that will like say whatever they want and then offer you a couple of lines. Like, I think there's a big difference in how you're able to apply things like that and how you're able to learn lessons and contextualize them.
Rather than taking someone's opinion who cherry picks certain information right. to then validate and further their personal opinion.
Exactly. Yes. And I never want that to be what we do for you guys.
Oh, we see it in the news. We see it in everything. We see it in every bit of media. I mean, this...
Yeah.
I will not pretend that that is unique to a handful of churches.
Yeah.
You know, it happens in every other aspect of things. And I think that's why, like, choosing the church you go to is really important.
Yeah, I think it's, at least for me, like, it's a good lesson in anybody who you're giving authority over you to say, you know, what time are you willing to spend with me? How can we actually contextualize this to be helpful? Is this for your gain or is this for a united leadership? Is this for the betterment of everyone? And are we able to see that contextually?
Mm-hmm.
And even in things like podcasts where we talk about this stuff, are you willing to take that time to sit down, feel uncomfortable for a little bit, but say, hey, this happened. These kids died. They're not going to be not dead because we don't talk about how it happened. They're not like, we aren't doing them any services by not talking about it. And we're not doing any further kids or potential victims a service by not contextualizing what they should have been looking out for that they didn't know, or mm-hmm. what we see that, hell, maybe somebody else knows why it's a bad idea, but we're seeing it and we don't know why yet. And we want to have that conversation.
We are merely just girls.
We're just girls and we just yap.
And we're just yapping and we love to yap with you, and we will not pretend to always be right. God knows we are no. far from perfect, but if we can have the conversations that we think really matter and encourage you to also have those with the people that you love, you know, then I feel I sleep well at night feeling yeah. like, you know, these things happened. We don't advocate for the awfulness that happens, but what can we learn? What can we do differently? And then how do we move forward and keep ourselves and each other safe? I feel like if that contributes to even like the smallest little particle of doing better, then I feel like we are doing a good job.
Yes.
So with all of that, do we want to jump back into this case?
I mean, we sure already did stick our toes in, but we're ready. So buckle up, bitches. Yoo-hoo! Pod's on. And just kidding. Yoo-hoo! Pod's on. One more. Yoo-hoo! Pod's on. Hi.
Oh, we really need that Yoo-hoo sticker. Okay, well, hi, hello, and welcome, or welcome back to your favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime.
Oh, that's us.
If you haven't listened to parts one and two, pause here, do that, come back. Okay, great.
Hi, welcome back.
We are continuing the series on Dean Corll, the Candyman. We have a very long list of sources. I mean, quite literally like pages of sources mm-hmm. that we've consulted for this episode. And if you don't believe me, you can check the description. We encourage you to check those out. Read up. Don't just take our word for it. Last episode, if you heard, we discussed Dean's MO and several murders that he committed, many with the help of his 16-year-old accomplice, David Brooks. David eventually brought a peer from school to Dean, Elmer Wayne Henley Jr., who went by Wayne. Again, fair. Upon meeting Wayne, Dean found him better suited as an accomplice than a victim. And if you thought last week was depraved, it only continues, so please yeah. listen with care. This episode includes discussions of sexual assault, torture, mutilation, all of children, murder, violence, and more. So let's learn a little bit more about Wayne here.
Yeah.
Wayne was born May 9th, 1956, making him 15 years old when he met Dean. Wayne was the oldest of four brothers and was born to teen parents.
Mm.
His maternal grandparents and his mom were his primary caregivers, as his dad struggled with alcohol addiction, was an adulterer, and physically and emotionally abused his kids and his wife.
Yeah.
Wayne felt a duty to protect his mom because she was often the recipient of his dad's abuse. And he felt this duty so much so that when his dad was attacking her, one time he aimed a shotgun at him and ordered him down.
And just...
to put that on a child.
To put that on a child. To put that on a 15-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Who was, I believe, younger at the time.
Right.
When all of this happened. But he had the duty of, like, the next oldest man in the house. And to protect his mom from somebody that he was also supposed to view as an authority figure. It was just...
Right. As
it's awful.
He's a kid. He's meant to be taken care of. He's not meant to be the caregiver role that young.
And yet he was.
So severely, but...
Despite what his childhood was like, though, Wayne was a great student. He earned really great grades and he did well. But he is said to have experienced some bullying. But... who doesn't get bullied? Yeah. I think that sometimes that makes you stronger. He was liked by the majority of his peers, but he was not immune to being made fun of. He was drawn to the hippie movement of the 60s and 70s, like a lot of people his age were, and he sported that longer hair that you'd often see accompany that. And you'll see these photos of him, and we'll have posted some, but he does have that longer hair. He's got, like, yeah, that lighter colored hair. It's longer. But what is the most striking about him to me are his eyes.
Yes.
He has these nearly translucent blue eyes. And in a lot of the photos that you see of him, they're black and white. And you can see just how light they are just from that. But when you see the photos in color, it's really remarkable. He has beautiful eyes, but there's a hauntedness to them. Like, you see them after everything, yeah, and there is a change. So it just, anyway, just had to point out, if you're looking at photos of David and photos of Wayne, you can always tell which one Wayne is.
I'm sorry, I tried to find it really fast. I, in part of my research for this, have been deep diving into like a shitload of archived newspapers, but one of them said honestly the same thing, but it gave him like a strikingly, I forget how they described it. It was so specific, and it was like a strikingly uneerie feeling when he looked at you, and however they said it, it was perfect. I was like, that is what it is. Like
that he looked eerie, like that he looked scary.
Yeah.
Or you mean that it was a comfort?
The eyes specifically, of like everything else, it could be noteworthy, but like it wasn't,
they look haunted,
anything to write home about. His eyes are what makes him feel uncomfortable to look at. Like, that's what sets off those alarm bells.
Yes.
And it's, I think, like, the mixture of how strikingly colorful they were and also dead.
Yeah.
Like, that mix is, yeah, so bewildering.
Yeah.
Sorry. Anyway.
No, that's exactly how I feel looking at photos of him. And I spent a lot of time looking at him. And you can see him, he's an older man now.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about his interview next part. But... he still has those eyes. There is no difference. But his parents divorced in 1970. And again, as the oldest child, Wayne kind of took on some of that responsibility that was left when his dad was no longer around. Wayne began working two jobs to support his mom and siblings. And he ultimately dropped out of high school in 1971 when he met David Brooks. But Wayne had also begun selling drugs, and he heavily used alcohol and marijuana, so he was already kind of on that slippery slope of,
yeah,
will he come out of this, or will he die, like, will he sink his heels into this?
And it's interesting, because I saw that his grades were really great until he started working two jobs, mm-hmm, and I almost feel like, well, first of all, like, who wouldn't? You know what I mean? You start adding a job before school and after school and expect the same things. That's crazy. But I almost wonder if like that was really the beginning of the end of like him having to be financially responsible, taking that on over school.
Yeah, if he were in a two-parent household that was not dysfunctional,
mm-hmm,
he likely would have made it.
Or even a multi-income caregivers. Like, even if one of his aunts lived there, like a grandparent or something, where he didn't have to take on this responsibility, that stops the step, the first step down this slope.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. Ugh. And he did drop out of high school. He did meet David Brooks. And if you recall last episode, we talked about David Hillegeist and Mally Winkle, and that they disappeared together. Despite their families being told that they had run away, their parents knew this not to be true.
Yeah.
David Hillegeist was the one who was supposed to leave the next day to go on a family vacation, a vacation I imagine his family was looking forward to and had saved up for. And he had his bags packed and his money was saved. He had $20 that he had saved up, and he worked very hard to do that.
Yeah.
His family knew that he wouldn't have taken off without those things, because his bag and wallet and all that he had were still in his room when he disappeared. We discussed this last week, but it bears repeating that part of their efforts to find him included printing and handing out missing flyers, which included a reward of $1,000. And many of David's friends helped hand out these flyers.
Yeah.
One of those friends was Wayne Henley.
Yeah.
Now, Wayne denies knowing at the time that Dean was responsible for his friend's death, but that is how much all of these overlap here.
Yeah. I mean, even in interviews with David Hillegeist's parents, they talk about Wayne being like, don't lose hope. Like, it's okay. He's got to be right around here somewhere. Like,
and I don't believe at that time that Wayne knew.
I don't think he did.
I do think, though, when he began, you know, working with Dean and David, I think he figured that out.
Yeah.
But haunting that he was friends with a lot of these victims, even before he knew they were victims, and then afterwards part of who he handed to Dean. So it's just, you think of, oh, this is a big city or whatever, but a lot of these kids just all knew each other.
Right.
Wayne, knowing David Brooks, knew of Dean only in that David hung out with Dean a lot. Like, he just knew Dean was around, but didn't know him. David invited Wayne with him to Dean's house, and we believe this was with the intention to kill him.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, Dean found that he might be useful in other ways, and Dean kept Wayne alive.
It appears there's a first time for everything for Dean.
Mm-hmm.
But stressful. So stressful.
Well, and Dean told Wayne the same thing that he told David, which was, you can earn $200 with every boy that you bring me. And don't worry, they're just being sold into sex slavery. Which was like, how the hell could that be viewed as anything other than evil? You know?
Literally.
How could the difference between, oh, I abuse them and murder them, and then, oh, I abuse them and sell them for other people to abuse them, are equally evil, horrific things to do to another person. And yet it was like Dean thought that was the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
To like, present to
don't
them.
Don't worry. It's just going to keep happening to them forever.
Well, right. And so Dean had offered the same thing, right? The 200, which was a lot of money back then. And again, these are kids that needed the money, whose family never had this money, and now they could have that themselves for something relatively, they believed, and easy. Like,
I do want to point out, where David's parents were divorced and he was going back and forth and they did face some financial strain, they did both have homes he could go to, where it sounds like Wayne had a lot of that financial responsibility on his back. And again, $200 is like, which again, that's just about $1,600 today. So that's a lot. Like, imagine the rent he could pay with that for one.
That is absolute madness. And to a child.
To a child who's been working, likely, minimum wage jobs in the murder capital of the country at the time, with no one else to look out for him but himself. It is kind of impressive that his first answer was no.
Right. Yeah. Initially, he turned it down. But at the same time, while Wayne refused to initially join this sort of team, I guess, he didn't report him.
Right.
He didn't tell anyone anything. He just didn't help.
Yeah.
But when the times got more tough financially for his family in early 1972, Wayne changed his tune and he ultimately agreed.
Yeah.
Dean and Wayne drove around in the Plymouth GTX, that same one that Dorothy Hilligay saw in her neighborhood when her son was taken, and they spotted a boy that Dean wanted. Wayne, acting as his accomplice, talked the guy up and invited him to Dean's to smoke weed and hang out, to which this boy agreed. He was brought to Dean's apartment, and according to Wayne, Dean tricked the boy into handcuffs. As we talked about last week, was one of his sort of go-tos to subdue somebody easily, where they literally subdue themselves. And then Dean taped his mouth. And Wayne left before he saw what happened next. He knew it wasn't good. But at that time, he believed that this boy was sold into slavery. Later, he knew that the boy had been killed. We still do not know this victim's name, but that next day, Wayne collected his $200.
Yeah.
We see the number of victims escalate because Dean now has not one, but two accomplices. And Wayne is useful in a different way than David. We'll talk later about the perceived differences between David and Wayne, and we'll talk about what we individually think about those differences, but it's very important to note here that Wayne took on a primary role.
Yes.
Wayne didn't just provide the victims to Dean, although he did that too. He played an active part in the torture and assault of them as well.
Multiple, yeah.
While David was often present for the murders and participated in the disposal of the bodies, Wayne seemed to enjoy his active part in the murders themselves. And it's as if Dean, when he decided to spare Wayne, might have recognized a bit of himself in Wayne. And kind of like game recognizes game. He saw a usefulness in him that he clocked when at least David didn't.
In one of the newspaper articles from the Pittsburgh Press that's linked, there is a quote from David that says, Henley, Wayne, took an active part in the killings. He seemed to enjoy causing the pain, which is just haunting.
Yeah, because he did.
Yeah.
Now, 18-year-old Frank Aguirre worked at a local Long John Silver's. Teens would hang out in the parking lot of the restaurant, and after his shift one day, Frank went outside to hang out and see what everyone was up to. I imagine, like, hanging out in the trunks of cars, you know, sitting in the back of a pickup truck or just either drinking or just smoking cigarettes and kind of hanging out, but he found a bunch of people, and of those people was David Brooks, Wayne Henley, and Dean Coral. And mind you, these are all teenagers.
Yeah.
And Dean. So if this far you've pictured Dean Coral as the life of the party, pumping his fist, sitting on the back of a pickup truck, swigging his beer, and making everyone laugh, you are sorely mistaken. Dean was always there, but he was hunting. He was scouring, seeking, pursuing. He'd find his mark and he'd make his move, but he was quiet. He was in the background. You wouldn't notice him. Dean maintained his reputation as the nice guy, and his interactions in these circumstances were sure to do nothing to disrupt that.
Yeah.
Because he was sure to fly under the radar.
Because in a lot of ways, this is part of the way that he can get his victims. If he loses access by making it uncomfortable,
by making it anything other than him just allowed to be there.
Right. Looking like a chaperone, looking like he has to be there, or is like, yeah, I gotta, but whatever.
Normal, cool. One of the guys he's cool to hang out with, but he doesn't say anything to risk rocking the boat, so he just says nothing, you know?
Right.
But Wayne was friends with Frank, which makes all of this that much more horrible.
Yeah.
At this hangout, Wayne invited Frank back to Dean's house to smoke weed, and Frank agreed to go with his friend. At Dean's house, and this is important, Wayne does the handcuff trick on Frank. He's learning.
Mm.
Once handcuffed, Wayne said Dean dragged Frank to his bedroom and secured him to the torture board. Also according to Wayne, this is when Dean told him that he wasn't selling the boys, that they brought him to sex slavery. He was, in fact, killing them. Wayne claims that he tried to convince Dean to let Frank go, but Dean raped, tortured, and murdered Frank and disposed of his body.
And I just want to say, I'm going to put a heavy influence on Wayne claiming to try to talk Dean out of this, because it is possible. I would like to say probably, maybe, likely, after his engagement in later crimes, that this isn't true. But I do think about this moment a lot in my head when I think about this case, because here he is. He said, okay, I'll start participating in this thing that is objectively bad that I said no to. And I'm going to give up that bit of my morality to give you this money. Here's my friend. And if it is true, he said, please don't kill him. You didn't say he was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And Dean goes, cute, and does it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And while I think there is likely a mix of a lot of things going on, the kind of terror that that would put in you to be the person on the other end of that and having been let go once and now still having your wishes sort of like overturned, like mm-hmm. not overturned, but like cast aside, I guess, has yeah. to be a lot to handle on anybody.
And worse so that he continued to do it.
Yeah.
Because we have a 4-part series on this case.
It's nuts.
He had the power to make this a 1-part.
Uh-huh.
Next, David and Wayne brought 17-year-old Mark Scott under the guise of a party. Though another source I found stated that he was taken by force.
Mm.
Regardless, we do know that Mark was one of these victims. Mark fought back and he got a hold mm-hmm. of a knife, which he used to stab at Dean. But Wayne pointed a gun at him and told him to stop. And that's where Mark gave up. Mark was overpowered, where he was raped, tortured, and murdered. And he was buried at the same beach as Frank Aguirre. With Mark, Wayne had strangled him until the point that he passed out. And then Dean finished it by killing him. Worse yet was Wayne was good friends with Mark. Mark's mother later recalled that Wayne had attended a party at their home once and had so much fun he was the last to leave. David Brooks said later that as Wayne got involved, he seemed to get more excited, like he was fascinated. Wayne became enthusiastic about murdering someone and he enjoyed seeing how hard some fought and how long they could withstand what was done to them. Like, it was a game. It was not a competition, but he got off on seeing the different ways people reacted to that stress and that fear. And did it make them double down and fight? Did it make them beg? Did it make them give up? Did it make them hang on? That was part of the appeal to Wayne.
Yeah.
In May of 1972, the trio took more lives. 16-year-old Johnny DeLome and 17-year-old Billie Jean Balch Jr. were taken when leaving Billy's house to go buy soda. Billy used to sell Mrs. Coral's candy door to door under her when she ran the candy business.
Yeah.
They were raped and tortured, and Wayne, at Dean's instruction, shot Johnny in the forehead. But when he did, the bullet came out his ear.
Ugh.
They thought he was dead. But when Johnny picked his head back up, he looked right at Wayne and said, Wayne, please don't.
Yeah.
Wayne pulled the trigger again, killing him. In June of 1972, Dean moved into yet another apartment. Dean's moving all over at this time. Like yeah. He does not stay in one place long. I think that that's very intentional.
Yeah.
Dean murdered 17-year-old Steven Sickman and the trio disposed of him in the boat shed. In August, 19-year-old Roy Buntman disappeared. He was killed. Into the fall, they continued to amp up. In one day, October 2nd, 1972, two boys were murdered. 14-year-old Wally J. Simino and 13-year-old Richard Edward Hembry. In David's confession later, he explained what happened to those boys. They were taken and strapped to the torture board, but this time it was one on each side of it, back to back.
Mm.
Wayne entered the room to join in their torture, and he was playing with his .22 handgun when a round was fired. The round struck 13-year-old Richard in the jaw and tore this boy's jaw off. Despite his injuries, he survived long enough to be tortured, along with Wally, for an entire day until they were both killed on October 3rd. I don't have words. The terror, the agony, the anger, the helplessness, it makes you just want to hug and hold those boys. Like, it physically pains me in my heart that anyone had to go through this at all, let alone innocent children who were denied the option that so many of us have to grow up.
And also, I grieve for their perspective of the world. Like, when you're a kid, even when things are bad, you're like, that's normal. There's still possibility. There's still hope. Like, it's a good world. People are good.
They're 13 and 14.
You don't start to question if other people are cheering for you the same way your family is until later. You don't generally think that people are awful unless you've seen other awful things first at this age. And to think that any of these kids went into that with, like, things are good. I'm going to get an ice cream cone. I'm going to go swimming. I'm going to go to the bowling alley. Mm-hmm. To then have that version of their world ripped away as the last thing for so prolonged, for some of the worst things that can happen to someone.
To go along with people that were your age that you knew.
Your
Why wouldn't you go? You know, it wasn't like, let me text my mom and see. No, this is the 70s. They're going. They're going to go hang out. They're going to go fish. They're going to go jump off rocks. They're going to go, you know, try to blow shit up. They're going to try to do it, you know, do what boys do. Go play sports. Go swimming. Go do whatever it is that they want to do.
Yeah.
And that's how it ends.
Yeah.
Ugh. In early November, 18-year-old Willard Brantz Jr. was taken. He, too, was raped, tortured, and murdered. Willard was the son of a Houston police officer who desperately searched for his son, and he was so pained by the loss of his son that he died of a heart attack while looking for him.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe because Willard was the son of a police officer, or maybe just because Dean enjoyed doing it, he paid special attention to torturing him. Dean cut off his genitals before he was killed, so he was alive for this, and then shot and killed him. And buried his body with the bag holding his mutilated genitals buried next to him.
Ugh.
In mid-November, 19-year-old Richard Allen Kepner disappeared while trying to call his fiance from a payphone. He was strangled and his body was disposed of on High Island Beach. In January 1973, 17-year-old Joseph Allen Lyles was lured to Dean by David Brooks under the guise of a party, and he, too, was tortured and killed. Wayne was not present for this murder. There was a halt in the murders in February to early June of 1973, but the reason might surprise you. I called this section Ouchie Ouchie Dick.
Wow.
Dean is said to have come down with a condition called hydrocele. This is when fluid builds up in the testicles, and it's said to be very painful.
Oh.
And in my research of this, it looks like swollen sacs of fluid. Yum. Mm. And can just happen randomly on its own, or it can be due to a torsion, or it can be due to an injury. And I have to say that the fact that this could be from an injury makes me wonder if one of the victims might have gotten, like, might have been able to get a kick in at him.
Yeah.
Or some other way to defend themselves to at least have, like, fought back.
Yeah.
But I also consider that maybe Dean hurt himself accidentally while hurting one of his victims. I think that there's a few possibilities here, and I don't know medically why this happened to him, but I like to think it's that someone got just a solid kick at him.
And I know that this isn't how medical stuff works, and I know we all have really bad images in our brain right now anyway, but when I do picture this and when I picture it healing, I kind of picture it like a punctured water balloon. It just kind of like has a teeny tiny little spout of the water coming out until it swells down.
Yeah, I just kind of wish that it never swelled down. Like, I just kind of wish it just stayed.
Kept going.
Yeah.
Push it to the limit.
Yeah, like if it was like he had to sit on balloons. Like, I want that. And it hurts. It hurts so bad.
Yes.
I, you know, I don't advocate for pain and horrible things for people. But I just medically, if it happened, who am I to say?
It's fascinating.
Whatever the root cause of this was, we don't know, but this did put Dean out of commission. Interestingly, as far as we know, neither Wayne nor David committed any murders on their own during this time.
Yeah.
Which could also show that they were only motivated to do what they did under Dean's direction.
Right.
It's important to note here that both Wayne and David were putting distance between themselves and Dean.
Yeah.
David and Wayne weren't friends. They weren't hanging out or planning anything together. They were, though, individually trying to make their exits from Dean's influence. Wayne tried to enlist in the military, but he was denied due to his non-completion of high school. He then took a trip on a big truck over to Florida with his uncle for a period of time, trying to get out of town.
Yeah.
Some sources say that Wayne tried to tell his uncle what was happening, but his uncle just thought something was wrong with him to be, like, making that up and fantasizing about it. And sent him back to his mom, being like, I tried to help your son, but
I don't know what the hell's going on.
Unwell, you take him. David called Wayne and said that he was needed. And it's also believed that through David, Dean threatened Wayne and said that if he didn't come back, his brothers wouldn't be safe.
Right.
Also at this time, David had a girlfriend. He was trying to maintain as normal of a relationship as he was capable of. And so his needs are now being met in a way that Dean isn't needed.
Right.
I guess.
And that's new for him.
Which is very new. And Dean is not used to not being sort of the apple of his eye, if you will.
Yeah.
And Wayne, it seems like, was trying every which way to leave.
Yeah.
And he gets a call that's threatening, well, if you don't come back, then your brothers are next.
Wayne, and that is one of the things that fascinates me the most about Wayne's involvement. And we'll talk more about it later. But he does take a more active role in the killings he takes part in. And it is said that it looks like he enjoys it. He appears to, but he also is the one who is so, like, trying so hard to tell people, like, his brothers aren't safe. So he shuts up. He doesn't take it initially. He goes and tells his uncle. Later, he tries to tell someone else, I believe. And they were like, weird. And then he's the one that goes to the police and is like, okay, just kidding. Here's everything.
So I think this too, and I know we're going to talk about it, but I just can't help it right now. It's twofold to me. So is it that he is desperately trying to get help and get out, or is he excited? And is it something that he can't help talk about because he is intrigued? The other piece to me that causes me to wonder sort of why he played this active of a role is that, is it because Dean doesn't need two Davids?
Right.
Meaning Dean already has a David. David is present for getting the victims. David is present for the disposal. David isn't really joining in sort of the murders themselves, but he is there for the rest. And in order for Wayne to be useful, does he not need to be different than David? Right. And so does he put on a facade that he's enjoying this and that he's game so that Dean will look at him different than David? Because he was like, does Wayne know how thin the ice is that he is on, that the line between accomplice and victim is so thin, especially for him?
I'm fairly certain I'm not going to claim with any certainty that that was exclusively it, but I'm certain that that is a large part of it.
I think it's so complex that you can't say, well, he loved it and that's why he did it. And I know we're going to get into it a little bit later, but I do think it's important now as we see them both kind of starting to try to branch out, to leave that life and not branch out to continue what they're doing with somebody else. They are trying to stop doing what it is that they are doing. That these last few murders that come in just such a quick succession
it
seems like maybe they don't, like, they are also nearing the end
right
here. And we'll talk about that. So they're trying to get involved in other things. Wayne would love to leave. David's got a relationship.
And Dean wants to kill, but he's got ouchie balls.
Yeah, he has ouchie dick. But once he was feeling better, because it took a few months for him to feel better.
It's a recovery period.
Dean seemed to almost be desperate to get back to it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there were 4 months between these murders, and then he's like eager for a victim and he's pushing on Wayne and David to deliver.
Right.
He started behaving strangely. They noted that he began like smoking cigarettes regularly, which was not something that he did, that he started to move in these jerking motions, like twitching almost. Like the longer he went without it, it was like he couldn't take it. And Dean was starting to unravel. Like he was, his temper was a little bit quicker. He, you know, he's, I don't know if he still did the pouting room thing at this point, but he had at first really tried to insulate himself from showing any frustration or any other emotion other than just being the even keel guy that he was known to be.
Right.
But the mask is kind of slipping around these boys and they are noticing it. And maybe that's part of what's making them so nervous, but he is desperate and he is kind of demanding. He's tense and he's antsy. And Dean at this time had moved into a property belonging to his dad at 2020 Lamar Drive in Pasadena. And this is the last address that Dean will have. Okay, maybe this is his second to last address because I fully believe he's rotting in hell.
I hope so.
So I think that's really where he is. But regardless, this is his last physical address, if you will.
On this realm.
Correct.
Yeah.
On June 4th, Dean and Wayne abducted 15-year-old William Lawrence, who went by Billy, little Billy Lawrence. His dad was the last to see him, and reports say that he had called his dad to ask if he could go fishing. I'm unsure if this call was at Dean's direction or if this was before he was taken and that was just sort of the last time that he spoke with his son. I'm not sure, but what we do know is that he was tortured for 3 days. Because Dean was said to have really liked Billy, whatever that means.
Yeah.
So this is one of the longer sort of torture periods that he had. And then he was strangled and disposed of at Lake Sam Rayburn. Prior to his murder, Dean forced Billy to write a letter to his dad to throw him off the scent. And we will read this note for you. Dear Daddy, I have decided to go to Austin because I got a good job offer. I'm sorry that I decided to leave, but I just had to go. P.S. I'll be back in late August. I hope you understand, but I just had to go. Daddy, I hope you know I love you.
Oh.
Your son, Billy. This letter was dated June 5th, 1973. So the day after Billy was abducted.
Ugh. Oh my God, he already had to go through a whole day of that.
He did. And the thing is that he wrote this letter and it's, again, designed to throw off the scent, right? It's, oh, Daddy, this is where I'll be. You can expect me back so that no cop is going to believe that he is anywhere other than where this letter says. And he was intentional in it being in Billy's handwriting, right? He really did write this letter. But the thing that pains me about this is that it almost seems prophetic, like he knew. He said, Daddy, I hope you know I love you.
Yeah.
Like as the last thing that, like I hope
want you to know this.
I need you to know that. Please know that.
Your son.
It was like he knew that he wasn't going to make it out of this. And that is just, if I think about it too much, I'll start sobbing and we still have the rest of this to get through.
Yeah.
But on June 15th, 20-year-old Raymond Stanley Blackburn was hitchhiking to Baton Rouge when he was taken. He moved to Houston about 3 months prior to his being taken to work construction to save up money. And when he was abducted, he was on his way home to see his fiance and their new baby. Raymond died by strangulation at the property on Lamar Drive. His body was also buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. On July 7th, Homer Lewis Garcia was lured to Dean by Wayne. He and the victim met at their driving school. So Wayne was attending like a driver's ed class, basically, and met Homer. And Homer was 15. He then received multiple gunshots to the head and chest and bled out in Dean's bathtub before his body was also buried at that same lake. On July 12th, 17-year-old John Manning Sellers was killed just 2 days before his 18th birthday. He was the only victim found fully clothed, and he was buried at High Island Beach. So I'm not sure what's going on with that one or why.
Yeah.
Maybe he was older and bigger. Maybe Dean wanted to cut his losses and not risk him getting away. So maybe he was killed rather quickly.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. But he's the only one we know to have been buried fully clothed. Just 1 week later, on July 19th, they took Michael Anthony Balch, age 15. Michael is the younger brother of Billy Balch, who was killed the previous year.
Yeah.
Billy was the one who used to sell candy for Mrs. Quarrel door to door.
Ugh.
These demons took two children from this family. I cannot imagine what it must have been like to lose your second child to the same monster.
And I...
like, to the panic when he first got, like... Just zoom into just this singular family and these singular moments where they realize that yet another child of theirs is missing.
Yeah.
Does it not feel like history is repeating itself? Do you not have that immediate panic? Like, oh no, not again. Oh my God, not again, not again. And you just...
Right.
There aren't words. I just don't have words. Two of their babies were stolen from them within a matter of months.
Literally. It makes me also think so much of the Waldrop brothers who were taken on the same day. And I think they're both incredibly traumatic and in slightly different ways. Because for the Waldrops, they lose both of their boys in the blink of an eye.
And maybe there was hope that they had like run away together or something. And maybe at least they're together.
Right. Or, you know, if they're not, it's one... blow, it's a giant fucking blow, but it's one blow where this feels drawn out and it like just tear. And how do you not start to panic every time you lose your son in the grocery store because he runs over to look at the Hot Wheel toy that's at his eye level that you didn't see because you're not looking for that, you're looking for shredded wheat. Mm-hmm. And suddenly he's not there and you go, oh fuck, it's happening again, and you find him. Mm-hmm. And then the one day he is taken again by the same person, like a year later. Just enough time for you to probably start doing that and start saying, okay, no, it's okay, we're just in the grocery store.
Because they're still looking for their other child. Yeah. They're still looking for Billy.
And then how many times does Michael run off to do something and they're praying it's because he saw Billy?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it's the hope that fucking kills me. And yeah, it's the elongated, like, drawn out slaughtering of this family, basically. I don't, and you'd feel so fucking powerless.
Right. And I mean, and we alluded to in the very beginning of the series that Wayne ended up leading investigators to a lot of these bodies. So yes, this is where these bodies are being disposed of, but they've not been found yet.
Right.
So all of these children are missing.
Just until
after Dean is dead. And Wayne and then later David end up kind of assisting with where the different sort of dump sites were.
Right.
So all of this is just there in the wind, which is why they're labeled runaways.
Yeah.
Right. But just that thought that now another one, and then the crash comes later when their remains are found.
Right.
On July 25th, 18-year-old Marty Ray Jones was last seen with his friend and roommate, Charles Cobble, walking along 27th Street with Wayne. Charles was 17 years old too, so we've got an 18-year-old and a 17-year-old. Both of them were lured to Dean by Wayne. Charles had a pregnant girlfriend at the time of his murder. Charles was shot twice in the head, while Marty was strangled with a cord, and both were buried in the boat shed. The final confirmed victim was 13-year-old James Stanton Dremala. He was last seen riding his bike in Pasadena, and he called his little girlfriend, because he's 13, he has a little girlfriend, to let her know that he was in the Montrose neighborhood. His body was also found in the boat shed. He had been strangled.
I also want to note something that I found fascinating around this time, because there are so many victims that are found in the boat shed, but then you have that introduction of the two other like river or lake sites, mm-hmm, waterfronts that trio fucking used.
Mm-hmm.
The owner of the boat shed said that Dean had been trying to get another one for a long time, but there just weren't any open.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how much of this was like, how much of them going to the boat shed was like, oh shit, we can't keep going out in the public, but now it's like getting unreasonable in there,
like there's too many.
Yeah,
he was running out of room. It it's very reminiscent of Gacy, where yeah. it was under the, you know, in the crawl space that there were so many bodies, they were just stacked.
Yep.
Like, that is the level here. These are mass graves.
And no matter how much lime or acid or whatever the fuck you're trying to do mm-hmm. to help move it along, it's, first of all, good that it takes a long time because it means you can get caught for a long fucking time. But, like, it's not like that. You can't just, like, put them in a bag and it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And the smell of that thing must have been.
Yeah, it must have been.
Sickening, nauseating. I can't.
And these are the last confirmed. And I just put, I want to like bold and underline the word confirmed. We're going to talk a lot about that in our next episode about just what we think it really could be, because I do not believe we know start to finish Dean's victims. We know what David and Wayne were privy to.
Right. And again, just as a reminder with that, these were the last murdered victims. We do still have two more to talk about that weren't murdered.
But I want to kind of just pause here and talk about those differences and similarities between David and Wayne, because the rest of this really kind of hinges on those differences. Right. And in our final part, those differences become really important. So
yeah,
let's just start with how they're similar. And this is just kind of my like view of how I think that they're similar. To me, the glaring similarity here is the lack of a positive male role model in the home.
Yeah.
Neither of them had that. And it, again, it might sound provocative, but stay with me. Time and time again, we see a broken family where there is addiction, abuse, neglect. And we see that the impact falls on the mental health of the children. Think of all of the serial killers and then look at their families. It happens, but it isn't common that there are two loving parents in the home. It's not to say that families like that are immune to tragedy.
Right.
And that things can happen otherwise. That's not what I mean. But by and large, you are going to find cracks in the foundation of a family, and then those cracks just widen and widen and widen. Neither of these boys had a positive relationship with many adults in their lives, period. But neither had a good one with a man.
Right.
And I think for a young man growing up, not having a man to look up to that they respect, and it doesn't mean it has to be their dad.
Right.
But a positive, an uncle, a family friend, or something that is not a nefarious player, not someone who is trying to gain access to these kids like Dean was, but I mean a positive to show you what a quote unquote man should be, right? Love your family, be there, work hard. Not someone who abuses women to lead that example, to be abusive to the kids. Neither of them had that. And I can't help but feel like had they, not only would Dean not have had access or, you know, had probably the kind of access he had, but also there would have been another adult.
Yeah.
Analyzing why that's odd, because man to man, why do you want to spend time with children like that? And then I think that there would be less of that. There'd be less room for Dean to fill that void, because there would be less of a void.
Right.
Like, their needs would have been met emotionally probably a lot better had they had those things, but they didn't. And so there's this like glaring hole in their lives, and in comes Dean, you know, the savior. And I would say even with Wayne too, I mean, primarily David that he like groomed him, but he became like Wayne's boss.
Yeah.
And he looked up to them. And a lot of men, young men, look up to their bosses, right? Especially if it's a company or somebody that you agree with. Yeah, I think. And that's really healthy. And in the same way that women having a strong female role model is so important, right? They lacked that. And to me, it is so evident.
Well, it is the exact point behind, like, everybody needs representation. Like, you need to see someone that you feel represents you mm-hmm. doing well, that you can forge a positive relationship with. And taking this on a slightly zoomed out lens, knowing that they both did have these cracks in their family and sort of emotional development foundation, he might not have been the best person to fill that role for them, but somebody was going to.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that zoomed out lens a little bit, this is why in sociology and in general to like people's lives, it's important that your kids stay in school. It's important that they're doing extracurriculars. And yes, A lot of the time, it is just to have structured time because kids need structured time, whatever the fuck that is.
Yeah, being involved in a sport, but being part of a team, having a coach to look up to, that is different than the family. You know,
exposure
to those things is so helpful. And these kids did not have that.
No. And these are all part of those safety nets that you talk about in society. Mm-hmm. Like, you have your family, that's a safety net. If you end up falling through the holes in a safety net, you end up at the next one, which for a lot of kids is school. If you drop out of school, you're falling through the grid on that one. And then you have churches or extracurriculars like sports or whatever, the places that you're going that you don't have to be at as extra layers. And they had none of it. They fell right through that first net. They dropped out of school, got through the second one, and landed right in the hands of this guy. And so whatever that need they had was, and I definitely agree, like they did not have good role models in any way. Neither of them had a good male role model.
No.
Not a representative model for them to look up to in any way. So they got the first person who seemed sort of decent before he wasn't.
Well, and then David's dad was emotionally unavailable and abusive. Mm-hmm. And then Wayne's dad was physically abusive and no doubt also emotionally abusive. Yeah. I feel like we rarely see physical abuse without also the emotional abuse.
Yeah.
And that was kind of their roadmap. And it was like anything was better than that. And then here's this guy who seems to want to take on that role. Why wouldn't you want to foster that as a child?
Right.
And it's our human instinct to seek to fulfill our unmet needs. In other words, we search for what we think we're missing. And it doesn't mean that we're going to find the right one. It means that we will find one. These boys were looking for a male role model, especially David. I think David really is kind of who I'm talking about more so in this, because he was so much younger and because that gap was so much bigger that he had nothing to compare it to.
Right.
What's a good role model when you've never had one?
Yeah.
You know? And then they found Dean. But here's where I think that they're different. David was a sad, lost boy, having been groomed for years before he became an accomplice. And he seemingly became an accomplice by accident. Remember, he walked in on Dean with those two boys and then he just left.
Yeah.
And his obedience and silence, maybe that was the catalyst that kind of put him into compliance with Dean. Like, Dean realized, oh, I could actually use him. I don't think initially he was like, I'm going to use David and here's what I'm grooming him to do. I think it probably happened by accident that he happened to not say anything and it didn't deter him from coming back.
Right.
And then he thought, oh, this could actually be useful to me. And really with this, when he walked in on it, Dean had two options. He could use him or he could kill him.
Right.
You know, either way, he knew too much and he chose the former. David looked to him as a father figure, but he also felt desired and perhaps most importantly to a child, taken care of. So now he felt this loyalty to Dean now. And I think that that's kind of the root of this, is that loyalty to him and why he kind of fell under his spell. But with Wayne, this was different. We don't really know what happened during their first meeting. Maybe he was tied up and made a plea for his life that Dean couldn't resist. Or maybe Dean just saw something in him without that element, but thought he could be useful. Regardless of what it was, Wayne had to be useful to Dean. I think Wayne might not have seen the writing on the wall immediately, but I think he knew that the line between victim and accomplice was a very thin one, and that he was on thin ice.
Right.
And again, like we said, Dean didn't need someone to clean up. Like, he didn't need the cleanup guy, because he had that in David. So Wayne had to be useful in a different way, maybe to keep his life.
Right.
That he had to help. He had to take part. And it might have even surprised Wayne himself how much he enjoyed that.
Right.
David had a fondness and affection for Dean as an idol, where Dean and Wayne might have been cut from a similar cloth. Like, they had more in common.
Seemingly.
And these similarities and differences came together, in my opinion, in a way that made the trio really effective at luring, attacking, killing, and disposing of boys and young men, because they had mastered diversifying their skills, and that they had that really good guise of, like, these are teenagers. Like, what teenage boy isn't going to trust this other teenage boy who they've grown up with, who they've known, seen around, you know, ran in similar circles with? They happen to be friends with this older guy, but this older guy's letting us, like, party at his house. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
And the cool thing, I say cool, but like what made them cool was that there were some parties that Dean had where nobody got killed.
Right.
Like it really was just come they drink, just have fun. And, you know, do drugs, pass out, do whatever. And then you could get up and go home.
Right.
So all of these things made them effective.
Yeah.
And that is what is so terrifying.
And I also think you have a wide range of, I don't want to say looks, but sort of like how these boys come across. Like you get a wider range of people that would trust you. Like typically if you know someone as a friend, you're going to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's an acquaintance, someone you don't know super well, I'll trust you the more I perceive us to be alike. Like that's a human experience.
Yeah, of and
like,
David and Wayne are very different. So maybe you know David more and Wayne not so much, but because David's there, you're willing to go.
You're like, oh, I think we look kind of the same. We're into the same things. Maybe we've been through something similar. All right. Like you wouldn't do that to you, so I'll be coming.
Like, you see Wayne with his long hair and his kind of like way out there, man, like kind of thing. And maybe you align more with sort of that.
Yeah. And you're like, yeah, let's party.
Movement.
Let's
it's like, we can go smoke
fuck
weed.
It all.
And, like,
let's do it.
We can go huff paint at this guy's house. That sounds great. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Versus like maybe somebody more friends with David or more like David wouldn't have been drawn to that.
It would have been like, hey, man, I heard that like we can go listen,
we can go
to
listen
these
to
vinyls.
Music
like,
and
yeah.
Play pool and hang out. You know, maybe it's just different, but they were able to appeal to different crowds of their generation.
And Dean being so overtly unassuming, unoffensive.
He was the wallflower in the back.
They were like, yeah, whatever, he's here. Like, he
it's
literally doesn't say anything. He just lets us do this.
Yeah, and then he gets mad and he goes in a different room and you don't even notice it. Like, he goes and pouts somewhere else. Like, please.
Yeah. I agree. I think they became super effective at this. And we'll probably talk more about this next time, but I also think without Dean having David and Wayne, he would not have been able to go undetected for so long. We did talk about Dean's heart issue when he was a kid, mm-hmm. and it seems unlikely to me that you can be doing all of this with that heart issue without some sort of help, at least on the other end. Like that's, and I'm sorry to say it this way, I don't have a better way to say it, but that's dead weight that you're carrying,
mm-hmm.
trying to get rid of in an unnoticed way.
And also you have two young like teenage boys to do it, like who better for
physical labor.
Yeah, like you think Dean was gonna call someone like me up to help him? Please.
No. He's gonna look at me and he's gonna go, ew, a girl.
Yeah, and he'd also say, fellow heart murmur, you are useless to me.
Yeah, he goes, go home. He look at me, he goes, what, glasses, asthma, what's next, a peanut allergy? And I'd be like, hey, yeah.
No,
exactly. It's gluten.
It's true.
But in fairness, and I just wanted to put my little tidbits on this because Allie and I talk about it constantly. But we also do want to say that all of this information, again, is based off of only what we have, which, acknowledged in our first episode, is only so reliable, at least on this dynamic. We have Wayne's most recent interview and initial communications. We have the initial and, as far as I can tell, only communications that David had on this. And Dean's mother, who has been less than a consistent, reliable witness with everything else anyone else has said.
Not an accurate historian.
No.
And then, of course, we don't have Dean.
Right. And so he can't comment on any of this either. And then you have journalism and investigative work. But again, all they can find is what's available, which is not much.
And nearly all of his victims or confirmed victims are dead, so we can't ask them either.
Right. So we could be off base, but if we're off base, it's because the information that's accessible is. What we do try to do is put ourselves in everyone's shoes. And we've had a lot of time to discuss David, at least in last episode. So I do think it's only fair we spend a little more time on Wayne, because Wayne undoubtedly participated more heavily in the grotesque and inhumane parts of these crimes while he was involved. However, he too was a child.
Mm-hmm.
From what we can tell, Wayne was 15 when he met Dean. Although in his initial testimony to the police, he says he met Dean at 14. But I don't know. I did math from every other thing.
Yeah, it's a matter of months.
Right, literally. Either way, He's just about 3 years older than David was when he was first introduced to
me. A very formative 3 years.
A very formative 3 years. And while in Childland, the differences between seventh grade and ninth or 10th feels gigantic, because in many ways it is very physically different, in some capacities different, this is still technically the same general developmental age between 13 and 15.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, when you look at that, you should be going into it saying, okay, at the beginning of 13, you're going to know a lot less of these developmental goal points than you will by 15.
But they're in the same bracket.
Right. So it is all within the same era of development. And while Wayne did enter later on, ideally should have been further along than David in this sort of development.
Mm-hmm.
But as we know, everybody develops slightly differently. And boys specifically are known to be more likely than girls to start late in puberty,
mm-hmm.
and to start that development later, and could be slower to develop mentally over physically, whereas girls, or at least those born with female sex organs and lots of estrogen, tend to develop their frontal lobe before those who were born with male sex organs. If you were born with a penis and have testosterone, your brain develops that your amygdala develops before your frontal lobe.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's frontal lobe takes the longest to develop. That's what they say isn't done until your 20s. But it should start around this time. Girls develop this first because it becomes more of their thinking forward, thinking through. If you go back in evolution, some people believe this is due to the hunter-gatherer thing. You want to be able to have more of that memory storage to say this leaf is bad, this one isn't, all of that. But men, or those with lots of testosterone, develop their amygdala first. And the amygdala, it literally is Latin for almond, because it looks like an almond in your brain. That's a fun fact. that is the part of your brain that is in charge of your adrenaline responses, that fight, flight, freeze, all of those. And it's theorized to be why boys are so much more aggressive, because not only do you have an influx of testosterone, which can add to aggression as is, it's now developing that fight part of your brain first. And so you're going to be more likely to perceive something as a fight, flight, or freeze situation. And with that influx of all of those testosterone hormones, you're going to want to.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring this up because if this was Wayne, which it seems like it was, and based on all of the horrible things he did, it seems like it very well could be, and this is kind of me hypothesizing, but it seems like he met Dean right around the same puberty benchmarks. Perhaps not fully out of them, but certainly further in than David. And with a lot of responsibility and needing options for cash, and someone that Wayne may be able to idolize in a different way than how David is, it's possible he took a very similar amount of mental damage in a different way. With David seeming to idolize Dean like a father, Wayne probably saw him as more of a role model than a caregiver. And with puberty and raging hormones, a frontal lobe that's nowhere near developed, the burden of adult responsibilities and money problems, and now being looped into something that has literally taken his neighbors, as being threatened to take his brothers from him.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he likely escaped death to then become a part of this, he may have thought that he and Dean did have more in common. Maybe it was the first time someone showed him in his life and through action that it was okay to be violent, that those rageful feelings that most teenage boys experience in some way or another were not only valid, but something that could be taken out on someone else. And I want to be very clear. I never want to be misunderstood in this. We are not saying that violence, torture, and murder is okay. It is never, ever, ever fucking okay. But what I am saying is, for a kid starting some really confusing, unknown, aggressive, and uncomfortable changes, and then to have the factor of being almost, likely, almost killed, and then keeping his life, we just don't know how much of this behavior would have occurred without Dean being involved. When Dean wasn't involved, Wayne wasn't killing people.
Yeah, I mean, I think Wayne surprised himself with how much he enjoyed it.
Right.
But I also think that, I mean, you're bringing up a point I haven't seen anywhere else, just about, like, you know, he's going through these changes. He has nobody to compare it to or nobody to talk to about it. He's only seen violence at home and he's mm-hmm. seen the destruction of it. And here's Dean saying, oh, here's an outlet.
Right.
And I'll pay you for it. So it's this positive reinforcement of doing things to people that are then silenced.
Right.
And yeah, it's a really completely wrong, backwards, immoral way to deal with those things. And he is financially and physically benefiting from it.
Right. And I also,
it's just reinforcing that further.
Yeah, there's so much reward systems going on in his brain, mm-hmm. whether that's the dopamine from the physical feelings, the serotonin from the money of it. Like, there's so many of these. And how much of this was inspiring and something he was pumped to join, or just how he was trying to mold to survive, or being surprised himself that it maybe was something to survive and then getting inspired by.
Mm-hmm.
We might never know. I think it was probably a mix of the three. I also just really want to quickly, in relation to that, talk about the diathesis stress model. I talk about this in a roundabout way in a lot of episodes, and this is basically that theory of like how mental health starts, because you don't see most disorders, most mental disorders present at birth. They yep. start at some time. Like, personality disorders are usually mid to late 20s that you start to see develop. And it's confusing for people because they go, okay, is this just latent in your body? Like, is it like a virus that's there but not active?
Mm-hmm.
What is it? And so this model essentially says it's both nature and nurture.
Yeah, predisposition versus environment.
Right. The diathesis is essentially like saying you have a switch pre-wired into your genetics. Somebody in your life or in your genetics has this, and it means you have the capability to have it. But just because you can doesn't mean you do. Almost like a recessive trait.
Mm-hmm.
And then this model specifically says that you have to have that switch, that capability for it to be turned on. And then also something in your life has to happen that aggravates it. So if this was something that surprised Wayne, that he did enjoy, that he was interested in, my thought is that it was likely something that he didn't know until he started doing it with Dean.
Mm-hmm.
Because every other recollection we have of Wayne from anybody else is like, he was a sweet kid. He came, he checked on the neighbors. He did good in school. Like, he dropped out because he had to get jobs. Like, his dad sucked, but he was protective of his mom. Like, he had a lot of positive values in the things that people say about him before he meets Dean. But he also has a violent father. He also has someone in his home that, or at least in his life, that struggles with this aggression and with this rage. And if that switch was off, and meeting Dean almost dying and being paid and reinforced to do it swapped it on, I think it was kind of stressful for him. And I think that likely would have been the switch.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Wayne that you hear about as a child does not seem like the same one who David says word for word enjoyed inflicting pain on people.
Right.
But I also want to add here, again, because Wayne is so much more actively involved in this stuff, I also want to add here that while we seem to see more of this kid in David than Wayne, genuinely because Wayne seemed more down to clown and participate, but also because David had been groomed longer, we're not saying anyone is less culpable.
Mm-mm.
We'll talk more of this in our last part, but all three of them aided, abetted, and collaborated essentially on luring, torturing, raping, sodomizing, killing, and burying victims without going noticed. This is horrid, and truly, at least I, Abby, struggle to see which dynamic here is worse, if that's even something to consider. It's all terrible. It's all the worst it can be, but I don't think David had the same amount of time tagged in during the commission of the crimes and the torture as Wayne did. But David did facilitate this, knowing fully what would happen at some point, and chose to do nothing, not say anything, not report it, but even more than that, fully knowing, continued to help bring victims into this and help Dean and Wayne not get caught on the other end.
Right. And when we'll talk about sort of the fallout from this, ultimately, like we said in the very beginning, and I know we're kind of looping back to that, Wayne is the one that ended this.
Yep.
for better or for worse, and for whatever reason that motivated him is debatable.
But he ended it in all ways.
But he ended it. And there is nothing to indicate that David would have done that.
Right. So it's all kind of a conundrum to me. You know what I mean? Like, it's mm-hmm. all just, it's tough. It's tough to chew on. And I have to keep trying because
I know
got to break it down somehow. But regardless, this is the specific set of circumstances to lead us to where we began. August 7th of 1973. Wayne invited 20-year-old Timothy Curley to that party at Dean's that fateful night and ran into Rhonda Williams, the runaway 15-year-old girl who he brought with him to Dean's. Dean, furious that Wayne brought a girl and not just boys, was not going to immediately show that he was angry, but beneath the facade of being the chill guy to provide beer and weed and other drugs, he was steaming.
I also just have to point out here.
Mm-hmm.
Because I read about this and it infuriated me in a different way.
Yeah.
Rhonda, who was, her just existence here is probably who we have to thank for this all ending.
Yes.
Because it put things in perspective for Wayne that his life was threatened for the first time in a very long time, if the first time ever. But Wayne had feelings for Rhonda.
Yeah.
And Rhonda, at the time of his death, was dating Frank Aguirre, the Ugh. Victim that we talked about. It was the first victim we spoke about at this beginning of this episode. So she's dating Frank, and Frank goes missing, and she doesn't find out until much later
yeah.
what happened. But it's possible that Wayne delivered Frank to Dean to just get rid of him, to leave room for him to like court yeah. Rhonda, which is horrific. And then all of a sudden, now Rhonda ends up at Dean's house. You know what I mean? It's just yeah. kind of that full circle moment. But I mean, that is just some of the most horrific, because you want to date a girl, a boy has to die. Are you kidding me? This is high school.
I also just want to like wrap her up in a blanket, because that means in the last year or two, her boyfriend died. Her dad's an abusive POS. Mm-hmm. Who beat the shit out of her this night, which is why she was outside looking for a place to go,
trying to run away, and winds up in the home of another monster
in fucking Dean Coral's home.
Mm-hmm.
So what the fuck is that about? Like, I want to give her a little hug and a cup of tea and tell her everything's gonna be okay.
I know,
a coffee if she prefers it, but I find tea to be settling.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is fascinating, especially knowing the interplay between some of these victims and our offenders here, but also just a reminder of how fucking small of a footprint this is on. Like, mm-hmm. this is a small area.
Yes. Like, per capita, this is ridiculous.
Yes. This is going to fuck up their stats for years.
And it should.
It should. So it was after the three teens inhaled paint fumes, drank, and smoked their hearts out until they passed out around 3 a.m., that Wayne found himself in the same precarious position for the second, likely the second time in his life, with his fate in Dean Coral's hands. The scene, like many of them, was one of nightmares. With loud music on the radio to drown out sounds, Wayne woke up being cuffed and tied alongside Rhonda and Timothy. Timothy, the only one naked at this point, was next to Rhonda, who Dean so rudely kicked and yelled at to wake up, which is like, you don't even like her. You don't want her here. Let her sleep. But he's kicking her in the stomach and calling her a bitch.
Yep, because she happened to be there.
I
know.
I have so many choice words. But it had to be slowly dawning on Wayne at this time that this wasn't his usual involvement. Somehow, he did convince Dean to talk, and he talked him into untying Wayne's cuffs, or undoing them, so that Wayne could help with the murders, as he typically did.
Yep.
This took about half an hour, which again, we talked about, probably felt like a billion years.
But half hour to plead for your life is a very long time.
Yeah. For a man that you've seen do horrendous things and you know you fucked up on his account.
Mm-hmm.
And this might be the second time that you're in that position.
Yep.
Christ. Anyway. After which, Dean did let him out, and he ordered Wayne to torture and rape Rhonda at the same time as he did the same to Timothy. It wasn't before Timothy and Rhonda were both secured to Dean's torture board. Wayne decided to interrupt the flow of their typical grotesque routine, and he shot Dean. This was a whole drama. You can read about it anywhere it talks to you about it. Dean's like, no, shoot me. You won't do it. Anyway, long story short, Wayne does.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Dean dies naked, face first, in his apartment.
Which those photos are available. I don't really recommend you searching for them, but you can just happen upon them. He is booty naked.
Yeah.
He dies up against a wall, so like his forehead is kind of pressed to the wall.
Yeah.
And that's where his body is left until police arrive.
Yes.
But he was naked because he quite literally had already begun assaulting Timothy.
Yes. Yep.
So like this poor kid is victim to this, sees this exchange, witnesses a murder, gets like let out.
Mm-hmm.
And then has to then tell the police about it. And then he finds out later what was going to happen to him. Like what the uninterrupted, what Dean would have done.
Yes. And also at this time, I mean, I'm sure they were confused and feeling a little weird about Wayne, but they didn't know his role either.
No, they didn't know that he was an accomplice.
Yeah.
At all.
I mean, I will say, I don't remember if this account was just from Wayne or if I saw it in any of the other sources, but I did hear an account of during this time, like before Wayne shot Dean while he was kind of like amping up, like he was like, okay, I'm gonna, like, this is too mm-hmm. much. I think someone had said that Rhonda was like, tell me this isn't real. Like, tell me this isn't like,
it, well,
kind of like pleading.
Rhonda was like, are you really gonna do this?
Yeah, are you real? And Wayne was like, it's gonna be okay. And like, that's what did it. Like, and I don't know whether to feel glad or bad about that, kind of both, because I'm like, that's all it took for you.
Yeah, but in
was
other
the right person being like, tell me that's not gonna happen.
The girl you had a crush on versus the other kids who pleaded for their lives. He shot them in the face.
Yep. So I mean, like, don't get me wrong, yay, it stopped. Incredible that Rhonda was there, because it's the only way I think this would have stopped.
But I struggle to like commend him for that.
Right. And I think it's so back ass words, and it doesn't mean I'm not glad it happened, but how we got there was a fucking weird road. So all of that to say, by the morning of August 8th, 1973, Dean died of the bullet shots to his back that Wayne sent his way. Despite somehow miraculously surviving the first shot to the head, Dean died of the wounds to his spine, blood loss, and punctured lungs that the subsequent shots delivered. Another piece of evidence to the grip Dean had on Wayne was that all Wayne could think about after shooting him was that Dean would have been proud of how he responded to the situation.
So twisted.
Imagine being that enthralled with someone.
No, I simply cannot.
I don't know how you get sunk so deep into someone that's what they're like. They're like, I killed him, but you know what? He would have been proud of me.
No.
That, like, it's disgusting and sad. It's so sad.
It's sad that in a way he's still like seeking his approval.
Right. I'm like, this man brought you into this, has killed and tortured so many people. You've now done the same, including your friends.
Mm-hmm.
You finally kill him. And I don't mean finally as in like he should have been the whole time. He shouldn't have been doing anything the whole time. But we knew it was going to end in one way or another. You finally end it. And you still can't shake needing his approval for that?
Nope.
So anyway, before 8:30 a.m., Dean was dead and Wayne untied Rhonda and Timothy. Timothy convinced Wayne to call the police. I think he was like, well, we should just go. And Timothy was like,
actually not. Yeah, no, thank you.
I think we should go to the police. And despite Dean dying, the other difference in this day was that David wasn't around, but instead hanging out with his girlfriend. I have seen in different sources different labels to their relationship at this time. I saw fiance and I saw wife.
I believe that his girlfriend was pregnant. Mm-hmm. And that maybe they had made a commitment to each other because she was pregnant, that maybe Got that's it. Why they were calling. Maybe they said they were engaged and maybe right. they did get engaged, but whatever it was, like, they knew they were in it for the long haul now, kind of thing.
Yeah. So I have seen a few things, but it obviously he was with right. her instead of at the scene this day. And so Wayne was on his own with Rhonda and Timothy, who likely had no idea how far back Wayne and Dean really went. They were just happy to be alive, even if not unscathed.
Mm-hmm.
At 8:24 a.m., Wayne called the police. He blurted out to the operator, "Y'all better come right now. I just killed a man."
Mm-hmm.
He gave them the address on Lamar Drive and waited on the front porch with Timothy and Rhonda. Waiting for the police to get there must have felt like forever. And in fact, Timothy even said at one point, Wayne told him during this wait that he must have done that 4 or 5 different times. Presumably, this meant shooting people, although it was argued in court that he interpreted it to be shooting people. It could have meant the shots to Dean,
because
there were around that many.
Right.
However, found it very interesting that that popped up in court and I could find an old article on it.
Yeah.
I don't personally bet on 4 to 5 to Dean. I think it was probably other people as well, but that's me. Wayne also told Timothy in this waiting period, "If you wasn't my friend, I could have gotten $200 for you."
Wow.
So just,
ugh.
You're a teen. You're 20. Actually, yeah, you're like, you just graduated high school. You're out. You're like, oh my God, I can go to friends' houses and drink. I don't have a curfew. And you find someone, you go there. You have a good party.
Mm-hmm.
You wake up being tortured or about to be.
Mm-hmm.
Your friend and this girl he likes is there. He kills the first guy. Freaks out and then is like, "Let's leave." You're like, "No." And then he's like, "Well, I could have gotten $200 for you.
I could have just killed you.
And I did this a few times before."
Ugh.
Like, wild ass waiting period, truly. When the police arrived, they described Timothy and Rhonda as weeping into each other.
Of course, Timothy they were.
Timothy curled into Rhonda and her like arm over him, which is just such a picture.
You just want to hold him, don't you?
Yeah. And then Wayne, standing, staring off into the distance.
Yep.
Initially, Wayne went into custody and claimed that he acted in self-defense, which Timothy and Rhonda corroborated with their testimony, because for all intents and purposes, that specific day was self-defense.
Yeah, that time.
But later, I believe it was the next morning, when he was brought in for more questioning, Wayne allegedly had another burst of information during their interrogation. And I think this is interesting because literally every piece of journalism I could find when talking about his confessions or saying things, like even calling the police in the first place, it never was like, "I'm going to sit down and explain this to you." It was like he word vomited. It was like he had to get it out. It was like, "I did this."
Yeah, like it blew up out of him.
Yes.
Right.
And this happened the same way in the next day. So he spilled the truth. The whole truth, and genuinely, seemingly, nothing but the truth to these police officers. Admitting in his and David parts in helping, and that he helped with the torture and mutilation of, quote-unquote, 6 to 8 victims before helping hide their death.
It was more like 30, but okay.
Yeah, I don't know if that is all of the ones that Wayne really was involved in, because I think he said all of the ones he knew about, but I don't know if he only played an active role in those or if this is him downplaying it, which seems kind of stupid to be like, "You're getting me on self-defense, I'm going to tell you everything and I'm going to tell you all of these ridiculous numbers, but I only helped in 6 to 8
yeah,
I don't know. But I want to just make a point here that initially police were really skeptical of this. They, like, did not want to believe it. They assumed that it was just Dean's death in this case. And Wayne had to be insistent, including naming various victims just for the police to take him seriously, after checking it with the missing kids registry.
Okay, well, if somebody came up to you and said, I've been part of this like underground network of the three of us where we have abducted, tortured, murdered, and disposed of nearly 30 kids, would your first thing be like, oh, I totally buy that? Or would you be like, what? Like, Wayne has a reputation. He is kind of naughty.
Yeah.
You know, like, I understand you should take it seriously, but initially, would you believe it? Because I would, that would sound outlandish to me.
It would sound outlandish to me.
You investigate it.
But. It wouldn't sound as outlandish to me.
Given all the missing kids.
Giving all the missing kids, but also how he's in custody. He's not in custody for stealing a car and then was just like, oh, I did this.
Mm.
He killed a man when two other kids were hooked up to a torture board.
Yeah, he did do that.
So, I think the context makes a lot of sense. Now, if a random kid or like a kid with known behavioral problems came up to me and just out of nowhere was saying this, oh, we're still fucking investigating because you're either thinking some wild shit, you're seeing some wild shit, or you're doing some wild shit.
Mm-hmm.
But
either any combination of those things needs to be addressed.
Right. So it's one of those. But if this was the context, you don't need to convince me. You just fucking tell me what's happening.
Like, right.
I'm in. I'm at least in enough to find out what the fuck you're talking about. Either way, they did check it and they decided to, I don't know, believe him. I find it fascinating that according to an article in an archive newspaper on this from the Sarasota Journal, Detective David Mulliken, who interviewed Wayne, said that Wayne told him he was happy to get all of this off of his chest and was glad it came to an end. Even after, like, you know, he gets put into custody, he's like, this happened. And Detective Mulligan is like, you don't have to talk to me without an attorney. Like, you don't have to say this. And he's like, no, I need it to be done.
I get that.
So there's not a lot of credit to give here. So I'm simply giving it where it is.
Kind of.
Which
do.
Is.
Yeah.
Two sentences and four parts.
Yeah.
But I'll give it to him. Okay. You know, he was like, it's got to end.
Oh, you're giving him more than I would, but yeah.
So it was only after Wayne insisted on the real victim count that he knew of, again, only the ones he knew of, and giving police names that were verified that they started to investigate more on this. I do presume that some of this was happening simultaneously because obviously you do have to investigate a crime scene, and I don't think they didn't not investigate the crime scene until Wayne brought this up, but they started maybe connecting some of the evidence found there to more of what Wayne was saying than they would have otherwise. While they were searching Dean's home, they found more evidence to support this confession, including the torture devices, plastic handcuffs, rope, glass rods, dildos, and more. Insane amount of petroleum jelly, which is wild.
Mm-hmm.
Disgusting. But then Henley agreed to go out with the police to the first of the burial sites, the boat shed. Here, media and news swarmed the shed as word got out that they were finding multiple bodies. And this is when you see that famous footage of Wayne using a car phone to call his mom and tell her, Mama, I shot Dean.
Mm-hmm.
And while that was certainly a moment of history to be witnessed, I can't imagine watching the news while that was happening.
I know.
The abhorrent discoveries of the day rightfully took the attention of the public, law enforcement, and the media. By the end of August 9th, 1973, 17 different bodies had been found in this boat shed. And that wasn't all. There were still many more yet to come. And by that night, David's father had escorted him into the police department to give David's testimony, and the search and identification were just getting started. The county medical examiner, Dr. Joseph Jakimeski, I think is how you say it, said, "We have many bones, and we don't know which go with which bodies." But there were still so many more to uncover at this point. And that, dear listener, is where we're going to leave you for part three. Come back next week for the final part in our Dean Coyle series, which will include the exhuming of the rest of the victims, aftermath, and more. We'll touch on the bizarre and fascinating ways that forensic archaeologists helped identify some of the victims, the connection between John Wayne Gacy, fucking freak and terrible killer clown, with Coral,
mm-hmm.
and even more. We will happily and excitedly put this case to rest after next week, but we appreciate you sticking out the gory details with us and really getting into this tragedy that plagued Texas in the early 70s.
We thank you guys for sticking it out with us, because I know this case is not something easy to listen to. It certainly has not been easy to research.
Mm-mm.
But if you've liked what you've heard and you want to support us, we'd love if you did that. And you can definitely do that by definitely telling somebody.
Ooh.
Or maybe even several people,
yeah,
about your favorite true crime podcast. I don't know. I'm not you. Just
wait, a bad time for true crime?
Yeah, that one.
Oh.
And if you wanted to rate us 5 stars, if you want to comment below, if you're listening on Spotify, where you're listening from, because I always geek out over, because we're just, you know, our tiny little place in New England, and that's where we're living, and
we love it.
Just want to know where you're listening from, and we just love getting to hang out with you every week, and we hope that we see you next week.
Yeah. In the meantime, again, check out our Instagram. You can see the people, the places, the things that we talk about. You can find that down below in our link tree. We'd love it if you left us a comment on Spotify, if that's where you're listening, or on Instagram, if you're on Apple or Google Podcasts. I know we have a few people listening in different spots, but we do. We really love hearing from you and interacting with you guys. If you want, you could send us a little email and tell us all of the things you want to tell us within reason, please. And we'd love to see all the pod pets, hear all your recommendations. And, you know, if I look at my clock, that was
about time for true crime.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
I need a cigarette.
You don't smoke.
I know.